The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On June 24, 2009, James Person, coordinator of the North Korea International Documentation Project, at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, spoke to the Korea Society about the Democratic People's Republic of Korea's complex and frequently misunderstood relations with the People's Republic of China. His presentation drew on newly obtained archival documents that shed light on past and present challenges to the Sino-North Korean alliance.
Thank you, Fred. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to start by thanking the Korea Society for asking me to come to speak about Sino-DPRK relations. I'm pleased by the number of people here today. I only wish the folks in Washington were half as interested in listening about something that happened more than a decade ago, and also half as willing to relate these past events to current events. Mao Zedong once described the Sino-DPRK alliance as being as close as lips and teeth. Now, in truth, the 60-year history of the Sino-DPRK alliance has been littered with instances of tension and conflict. The conventional wisdom, however, at least in Washington, is that North Korea and the People's Republic of China have remained staunch allies ever since tens of thousands of Chinese people's volunteers intervened in the Korean War in 1950 to save the DPRK from being wiped off the face of the earth. Because of China's support for North Korea from 1950 to 1953, and because of a supposed shared communist ideology, it is assumed that China and North Korea are still very close, and that China has more influence and leverage over North Korea than any other country. Now, in recent years, much has been written in the press about the PRC's current frustrations with its neighbor and ally, especially since 2006, when North Korea first test-fired a Taebaek-dong missile and then conducted its first nuclear test, despite Beijing's assurances to the world that it could restrain Pyongyang. Yet, as I'll describe today, Sino-DPRK relations underwent a marked deterioration long before the events of 2006. I don't want to describe how North Korea has been an unpredictable and unreliable ally to China, as many have done. Instead, I'd like to focus on North Korea's perceptions of the 60-year alliance. Now, we have much more history to call upon than we think. The North Korea International Documentation Project at the Woodrow Wilson Center has over 60,000 pages of documents on North Korea from the archives of the DPRK's former communist allies. Among the documents in our collection are conversations between North Korean leaders and the other communist officials, government-to-government correspondence, and detailed analyses of conditions inside North Korea prepared by embassies in Pyongyang. Most of these documents come from Russian archives, but we have documents from Albanian archives, Romanian, Czech, Hungarian, Polish, and we are now getting into Chinese archives. And in fact, established a partnership with the Chinese Foreign Ministry Archive to get materials not just on North Korea, but including on North Korea. Now, history matters. I'm not just saying this because of the time I've already invested in my uh, my education as a professional historian, but history matters in general and in particular in the case of North Korea. There's been a remarkable degree of continuity in the ruling cadres of the country, in its political system, in its economic system, and in its security concerns. Now, this is not to suggest that North Korea does not change. There is not stasis, but deep continuity. And because of the troubled 60-year history of the Sino-DPRK alliance, there exists, at the very root of the alliance, a profound sense of distrust towards Beijing. Now, there are two fundamental reasons for this. First, throughout the 60 years of the alliance, China has at times directly interfered or meddled in North Korean sovereign affairs. And Pyongyang considers this a Chinese attempt to reaffirm or to reassert its hegemony over Korea and to make clear the hierarchy of relations in the region. Second, North Korea feels it was betrayed by China when Beijing abandoned the revolutionary state in favor of economic development. I'm going to examine each of these in turn, starting with China's intervention in North Korean sovereign affairs, but first a little background. Now, the Westphalian state system based on sovereign equality was introduced to East Asia only in the late 19th century. For nearly 2,000 years, until China was decentered following its defeat in the 1894-1895 Sino-Japanese War, a Sino-centric tributary system served as the core organizing principle in Asian international politics. Joseon Korea was part of the Sino-centric state system, which had its own sovereignty norms based on hierarchy and unequal status among states. Smaller peripheral countries paid tribute to China in exchange for security and for the Middle Kingdom's favor. Now, the Korean term for this tributary relationship with China was Sade, which translates to serving the great. Now, if we look at the history of Sino-Korean relations, going back several centuries, for all this talk about Sade and serving the great and subservience to China, the Koreans never really believed it. If you really look carefully at the correspondence between the Qing and Joseon governments, you'll see that the Chinese were very frustrated with the Koreans because the Koreans never gave them the gratitude they expected, never did what they were told, and they always acted as if they ran their own country. The Chinese might have been the only ones who believed in the system because it served their interests. Now, that said, there were still lingering and varying degrees of influence from the Sino-centric system that Kim Il-sung found disagreeable in his relations with the PRC after 1949. North Korea's Juche ideology, launched in 1955, is in its simplest form a rejection of Korea's subservient role in any system, be it the Sino-centric tributary system or the international communist movement. Kim Il-sung was extremely hostile to all attempts by China and the Soviet Union to influence policy in the DPRK. And China did, in fact, meddle in the sovereign affairs of North Korea on several occasions. First, during the Korean War. Second, following the August plenum of the Korean Workers' Party Central Committee in 1956. Third, during the Cultural Revolution, and finally in 1980, when the succession of Kim Jong-il was announced. I'm going to describe each of these in some detail. Now, the first major sore spot, as I mentioned, in Sino-DPRK relations, at least for North Korea, was the Korean War. Yet little is known of Kim Il-sung's frustrations with China during the war. Although the Chinese People's Volunteers saved North Korea from certain defeat, the North Korean leadership balked at having in its midst a foreign military apparatus with control over field operations. There were also disputes with the Chinese over North Korean resources and facilities. Disputes over the control of North Korean railroads were particularly severe. While the Koreans wanted to begin focusing on economic reconstruction of the country once the battle line stabilized, the Chinese forbade any use of the railroads for anything other than transporting troops and supplies for their military operations. All rail transport was actually paralyzed while the two sides struggled for control over the lines. And these stranded trains became an easy target for American bombers. Once it was decided, finally, that the North Korean, or that a North Korean Bureau for Transportation would be established, and that this bureau would have control over the railroads, the Chinese still insisted on appointing their own deputies in this North Korean bureau. Now, there was also a fair amount of intrigue against Kim Il-sung personally by the commander of the Chinese People's Volunteers, Peng Dehui. Mao Zedong later berated Peng for exercising big power chauvinism over the North Korean leader, but the damage had been done. As described in newly obtained Russian documents, the Soviet leadership was very concerned about the Sino-DPRK relationship after the war. According to several documents, Korean leaders made no effort to maintain contact with the Chinese high command in North Korea, whose headquarters were located just a short distance from Pyongyang. At the same time, Zhou Enlai, apparently disturbed by North Korea's ingratitude, intentionally avoided North Koreans at diplomatic functions in Beijing. Now, the Chinese People's Volunteers remained in North Korea until 1958, helping in post-war reconstruction by adding to the greatly reduced labor force. This too caused tension in the alliance, however, and bore a striking resemblance to earlier Tang, Ming, and Qing occupations of the Korean Peninsula after providing assistance to military assistance to various Korean dynasties. Now, and I doubt this similarity went unnoticed to Kim Il-sung. The presence of the Chinese People's Volunteers in North Korea further increased the political influence of China. Also, the presence of tens of thousands of Chinese soldiers in Korea and their increasing dependence for food on local sources produced friction between them and the Korean people. Now, the next incident, which occurred 3 years after the war, was perhaps one of the most blatant examples of China meddling in the internal affairs of North Korea. Following a three-year debate over post-war development strategies inside the Korean Workers' Party, Kim Il-sung purged a number of policy opponents at the August plenum of the Korean Workers' Party Central Committee. This is the so-called August factional incident, or the Palwal Jongpa Sakkon. All of these critics were either Soviet Koreans or cadres who had lived in China throughout the occupation, the colonial occupation period, and had become members of the Chinese Communist Party. Four of the purge critics fled to China, where they informed Mao Zedong of Kim Il-sung's actions. To investigate, Mao dispatched Peng Dehui, the former commander of the Chinese People's Volunteers, while the Soviet Union dispatched Anastas Mikoyan, Khrushchev's troubleshooter. Peng and Mikoyan compelled Kim Il-sung to call another plenum in September and directly meddled in internal affairs. They forced Kim Il-sung to rehabilitate his policy opponents and to reappoint them to positions in the party and in the government. They forced him to publish a full record of what had occurred at both plena. They also compelled him to release individuals from prison to accompany Peng back to China. Now, this incident dominated political discourse inside the Korean Workers' Party for 3 years, during which time Kim Il-sung took full advantage of the emerging Sino-Soviet split to eliminate the influence of the Chinese and Soviet parties from the Workers' Party through a series of purges. Now, Mao later apologized for this affair. And by the early 1960s, relations between Beijing improved, between Beijing and Pyongyang improved, as North Korea saw its national interests falling more in line with those of Beijing rather than with Moscow, which at the time was encouraging peaceful coexistence with the United States. Now, this notion of peaceful coexistence with the U.S. was still unconscionable to the Koreans and to the Chinese, who just one decade before were engaged in a bloody war with the U.S. over the survival of the DPRK. And so during the first few years of the 1960s, despite earlier frustrations, Beijing and Pyongyang were perhaps closer than at any point in the history of the alliance. Yet, as archival documents reveal, by late 1964, North Korea began to take measures to limit the influence of China inside the DPRK, fearing that the influence of Beijing was growing at an alarming rate. Within a year, Sino-DPRK relations underwent a marked deterioration with the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution. China once again attempted to manipulate the inner workings of the DPRK regime by encouraging the North Koreans, or the North Korean people, rather, to launch a cultural revolution of their own. Mao's Red Guards also labeled Kim Il-sung a fat revisionist for allegedly sitting on the fence in the Sino-Soviet split. They reported in Red Guard newspapers that Kim had been overthrown by pro-Chinese forces in a coup d'etat. The Chinese also broadcast anti-DPRK propaganda through loudspeakers along the border. And then they set up slanderous displays in front of the PRC's embassy in Pyongyang. To restrict these actions, the Korean leadership passed a law banning displays in front of embassies. The Chinese ambassador, however, refused to remove the displays, explaining that China would abide by North Korean laws it liked and disregard all others. Red Guards went as far as to strap dead Koreans to trains crossing the border near at Shinwiju, with signs reading, "This will happen to you next, you little revisionist." Beijing also cut shipments of goods and resources to North Korea, despite pre-existing economic agreements. At the height of tensions, there were actually armed clashes along the shared border in the vicinity of Paektusan or Paektu Mountain. Now, many of the materials in the document reader that I put some copies out there are from this period. And they describe in rich detail the actions of China in North Korea, as well as Kim Il-sung's own countermeasures inside the DPRK. Now, by 1970, relations began to slowly improve following Zhou Enlai's trip to Pyongyang, where the premier apologized for China's past misdeeds. Official propaganda aside, however, the alliance never fully recovered. In conversations with other communist leaders in later years, later decades, Kim Il-sung regularly criticized the Chinese and referred to their actions during the Cultural Revolution. You see this in a conversation, I believe, in 1977 with Honecker. Now, I'm going to return to the 1970s in a few moments, but first I want to describe another perceived act of intervention a decade later. So in 1980, North Korea once again felt China was overly interventionist by criticizing Pyongyang's choice of Kim Jong-il as successor to Kim Il-sung. Now, under the Sino-centric tributary system, it was in fact the privilege of Beijing to confer legitimacy on a Korean monarch. It came as a surprise to the North Korean leadership, however, that in 1980, Beijing still presumed it could voice an opinion on leadership succession in Korea. At the Six-Party Congress in October 1980, Kim Jong-il was declared Kim Il-sung's successor. This move was condemned in Beijing. Articles were carried in Chinese newspapers criticizing the choice of the leader's son to succeed the father. Ironically, Kim Il-sung selected his son to succeed him precisely because of events in China. In the early 1970s, Mao began to cultivate his own successor, Lin Biao. Lin returned the favor by allegedly attempting to assassinate Mao in 1971. Fearing a similar scenario, Kim Il-sung selected his son to succeed him, certain of his loyalties. Now, I doubt Kim Jong-il has forgotten this criticism of his succession today. Now, in addition to being disturbed by China's overly interventionist policies, as I noted before, the North Korean leadership also felt betrayed by when the PRC gave up the revolutionary state in favor of economic development and American recognition of one China in the 1970s. As China improved relations with the United States following the 1971-72 Sino-US rapprochement, the PRC became less and less supportive of North Korea's use of military adventurism to reunify the Korean Peninsula. In the short term, there were some benefits to the rapprochement, even for North Korea. And the North even expressed support for the rapprochement, something China's other allies did not do. excuse me. Sorry, I'm actually getting over a cold here, sorry. Now, Zhou Enlai spoke with Nixon about the Korean Peninsula and about Kim Il-sung's concerns. North Korea's support, however, was very, very self-serving, and the Korean leadership had unreasonable expectations. Kim had expected that through negotiations, China would be able to boot the U.S. out of South Korea. The North Koreans soon got the impression, however, that the PRC had moved towards rapprochement with the United States, only to gain Taiwan in exchange for not reaffirming China's hegemony over the rest of East Asia. So Beijing increasingly placed its own economic development above fulfilling security pledges to its ally. Now, in 1975, Kim Il-sung traveled to Beijing, inspired by Vietnam's reunification, to ask for China's assistance in once again attacking South Korea. Chinese leaders refused to support Kim's effort to reunify the peninsula through military force, as he had unsuccessfully attempted to do so, or to do in 1950. The next year, following the 1976 axe murder incident on the DMZ, Kim Il-sung was actually compelled to apologize to the United States, recognizing that China could no longer be blackmailed into backing him up because of their economic interests were paramount. Perhaps the greatest perceived betrayal, an example of China's rejection of the revolutionary state, was Beijing's diplomatic recognition of Seoul in 1992. Not only was Beijing not supportive of Pyongyang's efforts to reunify the peninsula, the Chinese leadership placed more importance on their desire for economic development than on the revolutionary priorities of the DPRK. Now, China continues to place more importance on its economic development, and despite what many believe in Washington, actually does not condone North Korea's military adventurism. The problem is, because of the troubled relations over the past 60 years, China has less political leverage over North Korea and less influence than many in Washington would like to believe. With that as our historical backdrop, let me just say that although China may have been an unreliable ally to North Korea, it has not been a useless ally. In recent years especially, China has served as an important conduit for communications between major regional powers and the DPRK. China has served as a political and diplomatic protector and as an indispensable source of economic support for North Korea. But we have to be very, very careful in looking at the relationship between China and North Korea. We should not overemphasize the influence and leverage that China has over North Korea. But also, if not more importantly, we shouldn't underemphasize the degree to which North Korea fears and wants to do whatever possible to avoid dependence on China. Now, it should be clear, I hope, that North Korea does not fully trust China and has consistently resisted China. Yet, because Seoul and Washington have effectively severed contacts with Pyongyang, we are forcing the DPRK begrudgingly into the arms of China. Moreover, we are pressuring Beijing to do precisely what Pyongyang has most resented over the last 60 years, attempt to influence North Korean politics. The Chinese leadership recognizes this. It is no longer actively trying to, nor is it able to, influence policies inside North Korea. Instead, China is doing everything in its power to improve its image in North Korea, to improve its relations with the North Korean leadership, and to increase its limited influence in the DPRK, all at the expense of the U.S. and South Korea. The PRC embassy in Pyongyang holds weekly parties gala dinners, and celebrations, inviting the current and future leaders of the DPRK. China is successfully creating wide human networks in North Korea. By relying on China and by refusing to deal with North Korea directly, the U.S. and the RK are essentially empowering the PRC, allowing Beijing to increase its influence inside the DPRK and to reaffirm its hegemony. This is something the U.S. has long sought to prevent, and something North Korea itself does not desire. The past 60 years of turbulent relations with China have bred a profound sense of mistrust toward Beijing and a desire to engage with the U.S. instead. The year 2012 represents a real window of opportunity, I believe, for Washington and for Seoul. 2012 marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung and the date by which the state has promised to build a strong and prosperous nation, or Gangsung Daegu. The 2009 New Year's joint editorial outlined plans for a new revolutionary upsurge that will achieve this strong and prosperous nation, and building this strong and prosperous nation by 2012. The editorial also drew direct parallels to Kim Il-sung's Cholima movement of the late 1950s. This is being heralded as a turning point in the development of the Korean Workers' Party and the revolution, much like when Kim Il-sung set the Cholima movement in motion in December 1956. While the moderately successful Cholima movement of the 1950s was funded by aid from other communist countries, it remains to be seen where Kim Jong-il will be able to draw the resources required to open the gate to a thriving nation in 2012. What North Korea seems to be trying to do, and this new slogan of strong and prosperous nation seems to be pointing in that direction, is to diversify North Korea's external partners. And this can be read partly as an articulation of a hope for new and expanded trade and economic partnerships, particularly with the United States, South Korea, Japan, and other Western countries. I believe the recent increase in North Korea's military adventurism has less to do with supposed preparations for succession than it does with its economic goals for 2012. Pyongyang's aggressive actions are aimed at getting the U.S. to sit down and negotiate. The North Korean leadership does not want to rely exclusively on China and recognizes that it needs economic and energy assistance from the United States to achieve its economic goals for 2012. It had an agreement in hand for energy assistance in the 1990s with the agreed framework, and likely wants to return to this agreement, along with the normalization of relations and a security guarantee. Now, the slogan, strong and prosperous nation, seems to be a way to try to create a kind of momentum, taking North Korea to the next stage of economic development without relinquishing the authority of the state and without jettisoning all of the ideology that North Korea has been based on over the last 60 years. We shouldn't assume, however, that just because Pyongyang may be reaching out to other countries, an interesting way of doing it, but we shouldn't assume that liberal democracy and capitalism is a wave of the future for North Korea. Rather, North Korea, through this and other initiatives, may be representing a different kind of course, a rather unique course that may not be very attractive to many people, may not even be in the best interest of the North Korean people, but may be a means by which the state or by which the system can continue in modified form for an indefinite period of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I should have said from the beginning, but it's obvious, having listened to you, that unlike many others who seem to be primarily just consulting their spleen on what's going on in North Korea, you're at least trying to look at hard data from which we can extrapolate at least alternative possible explanations. I'm wondering, we'll ask for questions from the floor, and there are mics that'll circulate. So after you've been designated, please wait for the mic to come to you and identify yourself if you will. And we'll have the question. But let me ask one question first. In this, as you know, everyone is very focused on what is believed to be the internal leadership transition process and how much, and trying to sort out how much that accounts for both what is perceived as very belligerent rhetoric and other signs that in a sense, the PRK doesn't seem to care what the outside world thinks. I'm not quite sure I understood from what you said precisely what you think the Chinese position in that process, or what the Chinese influence may or may not be in that transition. You talked about the past, but are they, you know, I think some people would speculate maybe if things really go bad, they'll set up a puppet regime and, you know, essentially start the process of reincorporating the northern half of Korea into the Goguryeo, which they claim that is theirs anyway to begin with. Do you have anything you'd like to say on that?
I'm not exactly sure what the role of China would be, and I don't think China is supportive of the idea of another or a hereditary succession in North Korea. And I'm not so sure that they really buy into what is being said in Washington, in the U.S. and in Seoul, too, about hereditary succession. I mean, while the North Koreans do not trust the Chinese, the Chinese do have, they do have better, or they're more informed than we are. And I just returned from Beijing where I caught from Shanghai where I caught this cold. And, it's not swine flu. And thankfully, I didn't have a fever when I landed. Otherwise, I would have been quarantined and probably wouldn't be back here even today. I was talking with folks there, and they don't really believe that there is. I mean, that there really is discussion of succession in North Korea. That perhaps we are misinformed, or we're sort of grasping for any scrap of information and what's happening inside North Korea to explain this military adventurism, this recent cycle of military adventurism that the North is engaged in. If I could just sort of give my personal thoughts on the whole succession thing quickly here. I personally don't buy it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I mean, Kim Il-sung was a truly charismatic leader. And the North Koreans, here's a guy who spent 250 days of the year outside of the capital giving on-the-spot guidance. You know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a North Korean who was conscious at the time, who at one point in their life had never actually seen Kim Il-sung, or had never actually, you know, been in one of these photos with him. Kim Jong-il is not the charismatic leader that his father was. And a lot has happened since he took over. I mean, the systems of distribution have broken down. There has been, a lot of starvation, in North Korea. It's not even clear that he would have the legitimacy to appoint one of his sons, to succeed him. And I've spoken with some North Koreans and North Korean defectors, recent defectors, who seem to suggest the same. There are some more practical reasons for not, believing that Kim Jong-un is going to be the successor also. And that is, North Korea has this rigid class system, this Songbun system. Ko Young-hee, the mother of Kim Jong-un, number one, I don't think she was ever actually married to Kim Jong-il. She was just a mistress. She was born in Japan, which automatically would give her a very low class level. And she has no official status in North Korea. I don't think the party elite would ever accept his, I mean, despite the fact that he's Kim Jong-il's son, they would never accept the son under these. Yeah, yeah. So I'm not so sure that they would ever accept him. But now, do I buy into this idea that they're going to, that China is making, they're making preparations to put in a puppet regime? I really don't know. One thing I should explain, I am a historian. And the closer I get to the present, the more uncomfortable I am. So I'm a little bit uncomfortable making predictions like that. But I really think the North Koreans are enjoying all this discussion of what is going to happen if with the succession, with the North Korean leadership, because they get to save money on other nuclear tests. You know, everyone is talking about it so much without them having to do anything that, they can just kind of sit back and enjoy being in the news, which is what they really want. So.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting interpretation that we're actually a surrogate atomic weapon through running our mouth the way we do. You were first, I think. So there's the microphone right behind you. Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, Kim, Cornell University. My question is about Chinese-Tibetan relationship. Has anything to do with the Chinese and North Korean relationship? In recent years, the Tibetan issues has gotten out of hand in some ways. And there's some evidence that a Korean minority in northern China has been very mistreated or, less support these days. So the whole idea about minority support has reduced. Now, North Korea has any days indication that was in sympathy with the North Korean minority in northern China, and also any kind of support they are trying to do. Although the border incidents are there, and that has anything to do with the North Korean. I think that the succession issue could be also camouflage of the real other underlying problems, or that's a tactic rather than the real issue. I wonder your opinions about that.
I'm afraid I really can't say much about the
succession.
The Tibet factor, and minorities, the Korean ethnic minorities in China. I that's not something I really.
Okay, as a historian, then let me put it this way. My question: there's a similarity and differences between the Tibetan relations and North Korean relations in terms of Chinese, historical point of view, or the same?
Korea was always an independent state. I don't know that Tibet. I mean, Tibet. I don't know if Tibet incorporated. I mean, it was incorporated into China during the Qing Dynasty, was it not?
Right.
I mean, but Korea was always a separate country, though it was, and it was part of this tributary relationship, but it was always a separate country. So I don't think we can draw a clear parallel between the two.
Okay. Let's move on to another question. Why am I blanking on your name? One of our most faithful attendees. No, back to, well, okay, and then behind him.
My name is Cambria. I'm retired, and I'm just an ordinary member of the Korea Society. History does count. I mean, saying lips to teeth goes back to the Song Dynasty, when the Northern and Southern Song were divided, and there was an appeal that they join. Otherwise, China itself would be taken over by another dynasty, which in turn it did happen. So therefore, I do think that it has some relevance during the 60 years. The Chinese will not abandon the North Koreans, no matter what the tensions and the tugs and the pulls are. You say that you think that the U.S. is pushing North Korea into China's hand, but that is a logical extension of the Bush policy and currently the Obama policy. Don't you think the current cascading of events, which have inflamed tensions in Far East Asia, is a result of the Obama administration knee-jerk reaction to the missile test? And everything from there, by seizing the UN Security Council, has just gone out of control, including tearing up the armistice agreement.
I look at this from the – I think what North Korea is – I mean, I am trying to look at everything from the North Korean angle. Why is North Korea engaging in military adventurism again? What I see at work here is this is part of this cycle that has been repeating itself for the past four decades. Starting in 1968 with the seizure of the USS Pueblo. When the Pueblo was seized, the North Koreans were actually calculating that they could blackmail the Soviets and the Chinese to unite and come together against the increasing US aggression in Asia. They actually anticipated that the US would respond militarily to the seizure of the Pueblo. And because of these, mutual defense agreements that they had with the Chinese and the Soviets from 61, they thought they would be forced to come together to confront the U.S. aggression. What happened instead is that the U.S. didn't respond militarily as the North Koreans had gambled. They were in Vietnam. But the North Koreans genuinely believed — you can see this in some of the documents — they thought the U.S. was going to attack, and they were preparing, actually making preparations militarily for this response. They thought the U.S. was an aggressor and that the U.S. was going to respond. But the most important thing is they were really trying to get the Soviets and the Chinese to work together because of this, after the Sino-Soviet split. What happened is, as I said, the U.S. did not respond militarily. Instead, the U.S. sat down and negotiated with the North Koreans and gave them what they wanted in return for the safe return of the crew of the USS Pueblo. North Korea saw this example. Okay, what do we do? We escalate tensions. We engage in military adventurism. We gain leverage over the United States and the U.S. You know, not only do they not respond militarily, but they'll actually sit down and negotiate with us. Now, fast forward to the 1970s, 74, the North Koreans approach the U.S. They say, look, let's scrap this whole armistice agreement. Let's engage in peaceful dialogue here. Let's come up with a U.S. DPRK treaty and establish some sort of relationship here. They followed up with letters to the U.S. Congress, to Ford, to Carter. What happened? Nothing. Washington ignored North Korea's advances. Fast forward to the 90s. What does North Korea need to do to get Washington's attention? The two Koreas were left in the cold after the collapse of the communist bloc. What does North Korea do? Well, what did we learn back in 68? We learned that you get leverage over the U.S. You engage in military adventurism and Washington will sit down. And what did we do? Just that. I think the North Koreans were gambling. They were thinking the same thing was going to happen this time. They thought that the U.S. is so afraid of proliferation, of nuclear proliferation, so afraid of North Korea sharing weapons with terrorists all you have to do is suggest that this might happen, engage in military adventurism again, and they will sit down with you and negotiate. And what is happening? I think I mean, I'm surprised that, I mean, I don't really, I think North Korea is engaging in military adventurism because they're trying to get the U.S. to sit down and negotiate again. But what we have is, it's a different ballgame right now because the current administration is not responding. And some, I'm not sure what's happening right now. And quite honestly, I don't even know that we've done a policy review on North Korea yet. I think we're sort of waiting. I was talking with some Chinese, or some officials, and they were saying, I guess the U.S. is just ignoring the issue, hoping that North Korea will sort of just come to its senses soon and realize that this policy or this cycle is not going to work with the new administration.
Right. I believe Ambassador Bosworth, who should be informed whether policy review has been completed or not, was quoted in the Boston Globe or somewhere just before our annual dinner, so fairly recently, that the policy review was not complete, or when we finish it, or he said something to that effect. So that's part of the problem. Henry.
Henry Segerman, Korea International Investment Fund. One of the things you said was that China is not able to affect the internal politics in North Korea, and I wanted to address that. China supplies 80% of North Korea's fuel oil and energy needs, and tomorrow morning they could cut it off, but they don't. Most people, I'm just very old-fashioned about this. I believe in the golden rule. Whoever has the gold rules. Eventually, North Korea would comply with Chinese demands to discontinue the bombs and discontinue the rockets. A lot of Chinese answer that by saying, well, we don't want to destabilize the North Korean regime. Well, that's kind of a foolish answer, because then you just cut off the power and the fuel oil for a week or a month or something until they comply, and then you turn it back on so that, you know, they get the message, but they don't collapse. So I thought you might address that, because you seemed very definitive about the fact that they are unable to affect North Korea in any way, which doesn't seem quite logical to me.
They do have, to be sure, the economic leverage, but there are limits to what China can do, I think, because, well, I agree with you in that it's not logical that, you know, this whole idea of destabilizing the regime is not logical. And this is what everyone in Washington is saying. They're saying, well, you know, the Chinese are not going to, to apply this economic leverage over North Korea. They're not going to shut off the oil. They're not going to shut off the electricity or whatnot, because, they're afraid of refugees streaming across the border. What I think is happening here is China understands that North Korea is not going to disappear. I mean, now, we can eliminate the weapons from North Korea tomorrow. And for the U.S., the North Korea problem is suddenly gone then. You don't have to, it's no longer a headache. You can go on to the crisis du jour and maybe North Korea will pop up on the radar screen again later. But for now, it's no more of a problem. For China, North Korea is not something that just, you know, tomorrow the problem will be gone. They share an 800 mile long border. And I think China is taking a much more sort of a much longer term strategic approach to the North Koreans. They realize that, you know, you have to have good relations with this neighbor. And I think more importantly, if you do, if you do anything to actually affect change in North Korea, that will actually maybe bring the downfall of the Communist Party in North Korea, then they're going to be in trouble too. The Chinese people are supporting their leadership now only because they are able to provide them with the with the lifestyle that the Chinese have become accustomed to. If the party, for some reason, with the current economic downturn, I mean, it seems, if a communist party collapses in North Korea, I think that there's sort of the relationship between North Korea and China. I think they need each other, ideologically. And I think, again, that China is taking a much longer term approach to the North Korea problem, a strategic approach. You know, you can't, do anything to make North Korea disappear. You also cannot, do anything to really annoy the North Koreans, because they're going to be on your border for however long.
Let me ask one question which may be related. Just a little over 2 years ago, actually in this very room, Kim Ge-gwan was addressing Dr. Kissinger, and he said, Dr. Kissinger, as you've written many times, countries don't have permanent enemies or even permanent friends. All they have is permanent interests. And Kissinger had a big smile that ran from, you know, one ear to the other. I heard Kim Ge-gwan make the same statement a couple of times after that, once in Pyongyang as well. And that's a very – I don't know precisely what he meant by interest, but I mean that was in March of 2007. I think what he intended to convey was that they were prepared to end this relationship of hostility with the United States without too much consideration of the past, without anything other than a real calculation of what they really needed and what we were prepared to give them and whether we could come to some deal. But what I'm wondering is it possible that those who advised, and I'm sure there has to be thinking like that in the Chinese government also, vis-a-vis their relationship with the DPRK. However, what I'm wondering also is, do they possibly have people in China who are their North Korea experts, many of whom I think have spent extensive time in the DPRK, who are perhaps as bad as some of the rest of us are, who have close connections with the New York Channel and other places, and we begin to have a capacity, maybe some people would say an excess of empathy, for seeing the world through their eyes. And we can make the case for all the perfidious ways in which they have been treated, deals that have been broken. And this case is almost never made in the United States, as you know, because, as I say, the rule of thumb is when they do something wrong, we blame them. When we do something wrong, we blame them, too. So I don't know. Is that a factor? I mean, it sounds terribly idealistic to suppose that they may just think that, hey, the North Koreans are being beaten up on and treated unfairly by some of these big powers like the United States and Japan and so forth, and we don't like that. Is there any way that could be factored into the Chinese position? Apparently, it's a useless question. He has no answer.
No, it's kind of interesting. The Chinese, when I was just over in Shanghai, you know, they were saying, "Look, we don't want to become like the United States and Japan by trying to push North Korea this way or that way." And I said, "Well, that didn't stop you before. You know, it didn't stop you before. Why?" Why are you reluctant to intervene or to meddle in North Korean politics again? But they said point blank, we do not want to become like the United States and Japan by forcing North Korea to do this or that.
And they may have, quote unquote, better experts now, yeah. I mean, than what they had previously, in part because they had that problem previously. I don't know. I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder what kinds of impacts a certain sort of sympathetic point of view, if you will, or empathetic point of view held by people who have a role in the policymaking process have on what actually is done. I mean, is statecraft simply a matter of calculating, you know, what the material advantages or interests are, or are there these other harder to determine factors that have a certain kind of different sort of historical resonance, right? Because they recall the fact that there is resentment on the part of the Chinese, too, about the way they were treated by the great powers in the past, now even though they're on their way to becoming a great power of their own, on their own merits. Anyway, too much intervention on the part of the moderator. It's a disgrace. Is there a woman here? I'm feeling I'm okay.
Yeah, it's Rhonda Hauben, and I write for Oh My News International. And my question is a little different. I've just watched the whole Banco Delta Asia thing coming up again, percolating up. And that was Stuart Levy in the U.S. Department Treasury. And there was the fight over that the freezing of the funds in the Banco Delta Asia. And suddenly we hear that Stuart Levy's going around the capitals and is the advisor, and Christopher Hill is out, but Stuart Levy is in the Obama administration. My question is some of the U.S. policy really directed at China and challenging and trying to contain China? Because there was testimony from the neocons to the U.S. Congress that the whole policy of Banco Delta Asia was to the Chinese proverb, kill the chickens to scare the monkeys, and the monkeys were China, and the chicken was North Korea. So is there a hostility of the U.S. or an effort to contain China that really the U.S. hardline against North Korea now is really what behind what Obama's doing?
Well, no, that's interesting, but I'm afraid I wouldn't know. I haven't spoken about that with anyone before. I mean, I haven't heard that come up. Not that I'm aware of. No one is.
You're having about as much success as me, so we'll have to pass on to somebody else. John.
John, yes.
John Kim. Thank you for your excellent presentation. I learned a lot about China-DPRK relations. My question is two questions. First, to what extent the Chinese government has declassified their government documents on the Korean War, and how much access you have to those documents? And the second question is, since China is now has a lot of economic power, it has a certain influence with the United States, why doesn't China try to play a constructive role to end the Korean War between the North Korea and the United States? I mean, as you said, China really betrayed North Korea to a certain sense by normalizing its relation with Seoul, while U.S. was not normalizing its relation with North Korea in 1991. Okay. So in that sense, now since China is more powerful, against the United States, it could play more, a constructive role to try to end the Korean War. And Have you seen any evidence that China has tried to end the Korean War?
The first question, the Chinese Foreign Ministry archive is they've declassified many of their materials through, I think, 1965. Now, the North Korea International Documentation Project is our partner project is the Cold War International History Project, and they're the ones who first started getting all the Soviet documents. The Cold War Project has established a partnership with the Foreign Ministry Archive to get documents. We actually will go over to Beijing and we'll get several thousand pages of documents every year. And we go through, select some for publication. The rest of them are available for anyone to look at the Wilson Center. If you go to the Foreign Ministry Archive and type in North Korea, there are 3,000 documents, 3,064 or something like that, documents that you can look at. Now, the problem is you cannot copy, anything with the names Mao, Liu Shaoqi, or Zhou Enlai. You can't print. I mean, you can copy them. You can sit there and copy them out. Everything else you can Xerox though. They're surprisingly open. And there are a number of very good documents. In the document reader that was out there, you see one conversation between Kim Il-sung and Zhou Enlai. Actually, Peng Dehuai was present too, about the Great Leap Forward and the Cholima movement. So we're getting a lot of great materials out of the Chinese archives now. I'm actually quite optimistic. There's a lot more openness in the Chinese archive. It just kind of an interesting story. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect this with China. I mean, the archives being so open, but we just held a conference on Sino-Indian relations in the Cold War at the Wilson Center, and part of the reason for holding it was to demonstrate to our Indian guests how open the Chinese are and how they should follow suit, or they should, you know, look, we're learning about India's Cold War through the Chinese documents. Why don't you open up your documents so we can learn about? But so the Chinese archives are opening up more and more. China's role in ending the Korean War. I don't think the North Koreans want it. If you remember, 2 years ago, I think it was, the North Koreans suggested three or four parties getting together to negotiate an end to the Korean War. Most people in Washington were speculating that the one party that would be left out would be China. And the Chinese, I think, suspected this too and made an announcement. We will be involved in negotiations to end the Korean War should they take place, you know, in the near future. I'm sure they'd like to do more, but they're quite limited, I think, in their role.
Okay. We'll go here and then to John DeLurie next.
Thank you very much, Fred. I'm from Philadelphia, teaching at the Drexel University. I have done similar research as you compiled here, dealing with the North Korea between Moscow and Beijing. And I have a couple of comments. One is specifically on this issue of China and North Korea. I think there are two pointed issues. One is the Supong hydroelectric power plant in Amnokgang area. And that's been really major source of contention between Beijing and Pyongyang. As I know, it's not still resolved as of yet. And the other issue is really between North Korea and China, how to end the war in 1953. North Korea refused to sign the agreement. China, on the other hand, put pressure. Why was the problem? This was essentially a problem of real estate, if you will. North Koreans wanted to have as much territory as possible. The Chinese, on the other hand, were not. Now, I just spent a year in Korea as a visiting scholar. This was my second trip to Korea. My first trip was back in 1972 as a Fulbright scholar to Korea University. And when I was looking at your program, I'd like to suggest there should be a similar study on U.S.-South Korean relations. I have the tendency that in the United States, we just take it for granted. South Korea is not causing any trouble. If you, on the other hand, dig, you know, deep enough, there have been more troubles in our relations with South Korea. And that should not be, in any sense, undermined or ignored. That's a very fundamental in our understanding relations between China and North Korea. Thank you.
Thanks. No, it's an excellent point, and I think Greg Brzezinski just wrote published it, I think, 2 years ago, which describes many of the difficulties in the U.S.-ROK alliance. I think you can draw some parallels to the relationship. I'm working with Greg on my dissertation right now, I can't tell you how helpful it's been to examine the U.S.-ROK relationship or alliance and to draw parallels to what was happening in the North Korean relationship with both China and the Soviet Union. this issue of agency. The Koreans had much more agency than we like to. The South Koreans had much more agency in the relationship than we like to think. Now, dear, you mentioned armistice talks and signing the armistice. We now have I think some 12,000 pages of Russian documents on armistice talks. We obtained them just in the last year or so. So I encourage you to those of you who speak Russian, we can always get you an intern and apply to be a fellow at the Wilson Center or come down as a public policy scholar and work with these materials. They're just sitting there waiting for people to use. We're translating some of these documents. Of course, we have to prioritize, translations are costly and take a lot of time to go through. So,
John. Thanks, James. That was a really interesting talk. I learned a lot. I think you're right. It's important we get this history down as clearly as we can. So I wanted to, quibble with a couple of your points and just see how you'd react, because just looking at the evidence you presented for these moments of betrayal by China from North Korea's perspective, I'm wondering if we still need to put these in a broader context. So let me just go point by point and then see how you would handle it. So, for example, what you cited, the incidents you cited in the Korean War, to what extent, say, the rail transport, that kind of thing, how much of that is standard when two countries are basically coordinating a war like that? The issue of Pengdehuai, my background's in Chinese history. Anything Mao Zedong said about Pengdehuai, I would question Mao Zedong, not Pengdehuai. So when Pengdehuai was accused of not handling it well, how much of that is a reflection of Mao rather than Pengdehuai? And then a bigger point would be, don't we have to step back and look at the fact that North Korea really felt betrayed by Stalin and the Soviets? In fact, in the end, China did deliver, in supporting, North Korea in the Korean War. And so aren't these really smaller issues? The much bigger issue is that the Korean War is an example of where that the solidarity was forged in a real way. Then similarly with the Cultural Revolution, the stuff about the Red Guards, I mean, you know, as you know, all hell was breaking loose. How much can we use what's going on in Red Guard publications in Hunan or Sichuan or even in Pyongyang as evidence of what the leadership, such as it was, really believed at that point? You know, I think there are a lot of difficulty in assessing that kind of evidence from the Cultural Revolution. On the succession issue, my understanding was Deng Xiaoping in the end blessed the succession. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, but isn't that the last thing, the last taste in Kim Jong-il's mouth would be, well, in the end, the Chinese did, you know, bless it, but maybe you could comment more on that. And then again, with normalization, sort of same thing as with the Korean War, I was asked to do a thing here with Scott Snyder, and one of the big points I got out of his book is that, you know, the Chinese made much more of an effort after normalizing with the ROK to still keep a good relationship with North Korea, mm-hmm. contrasting that with what happened with Russia-North Korea relations after the fall of the Soviet Union, where they really just totally abandoned North Korea. So again, if we step back, isn't there sort of a different context? And then just following on that, I'm curious how much of this narrative you've constructed, which is really interesting, how much of that is kind of a fresh look drawn from the particular documents in your archival discoveries? Because that's something that is hugely important for the scholarly community and for the policy community too.
You're absolutely right. We need to step back and look at the bigger picture. And for the Korean War, for example, yes, they felt they were very, very – they felt betrayed by the Soviets because the Soviets didn't want to get involved. Just take, for example, so there was this debate in China, apparently, are we going to get involved or are we not going to get involved? At one point, Mao writes to Stalin and says, actually, we're not going to. Stalin then sends Kim Il-sung this telegram saying, sorry, China's not going to help you. Withdraw your troops to Chinese territory. Do whatever you can to save your behind. Imagine how you would feel if you were Kim Il-sung at that moment. You know, so you're basically, you know, the Soviets aren't going to come to your aid, even though they're the ones kind of that gave you the green light to invade South Korea. But in the end, the Chinese did come through. What I'm looking at here, though, is, so you have to look at this big picture, but in reality, the North Koreans are not looking at the big picture. And what is reflected here is how the North Koreans are what the North Koreans are actually telling other leaders. North Korea, and I don't know if this, I mean, how much this has to do with this Juche idea of, I mean, but it's, and it, but North Koreans, I think they really, it, Korea's really the center of everything. Let me just give you a quick example here. 1962, October 1962, Cuban Missile Crisis. This was a turning point in North Korean history, especially economic history. Because in December, largely because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, they adopted this policy of equal emphasis on military and in industry. Why? Because they thought that the Cuban Missile Crisis was a clear indication that if push comes to push came to shove, the Soviets would not actually come and support North Korea because they betrayed the Cubans. This was a reflection. Now, this didn't just reflect the state of Soviet Cuban relations. This also reflected the state of North Korea's relationship with the Soviet Union. They really saw themselves, and they looked at little points like this and things that to us may seem far removed and saw it as greatly affecting them. The same with the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 64. They were saying, well, look, you betrayed the Vietnamese the North Vietnamese by not responding for 10 days to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. That shows us that you're going to do the same thing to us. Again, if push comes to shove, if the U.S. or South Korea decides to attack us, we can expect the same from the Soviets. The North Koreans don't step back and look at the bigger picture. They go and they talk to these to other communist leaders and say, this is what happened. Here's this issue, very much focusing on the smaller, the finer details and letting that affect their broader understanding of things. They didn't always take into consideration the broader, what was happening in China during the Cultural Revolution. What was important to them is that dead Koreans are strapped to trains being sent across the border with these signs being, and why isn't, if this is not a reflection of, the top leadership's opinion, why aren't they doing anything to stop it? How can the government in China not control what these local newspapers are writing? These Red Guard newspapers are writing about North Korea and about the need to start a cultural revolution in North Korea or to overthrow Kim Il-sung. So the North Korean, I mean, what I'm showing here is how, what I'm attempting to demonstrate here is how North Korea perceives these events through the documents that we are getting access to. And we do develop more empathy, I guess, for North Korea, or for the North Korean side here. But I think it's important because this is genuinely how I believe the North Koreans see world events.
Well, I just to add a little something, I mean, I really think that the point you made about they really think of themselves as the center of this story, is maybe partly the key to this because, it constantly comes to your attention. And so but I found that this is true in South Korea as well. I had many friends, including one who was a personal interpreter for Park Chung-hee. And every time he regaled me with stories about what he did as the aide to Park Chung-hee during the Korean War, it was stories about how they frustrated Americans from doing what they wanted to do by such small things as letting air out of their tires and other things, and how truthful these accounts were in a literal sense is perhaps not the point. The point is that the recollection of how they related to Americans is that they were not totally dependent on Americans. They were themselves, even though, you know, if the Americans hadn't intervened, maybe they wouldn't have had any place to remain on the Korean Peninsula. So I think, and also I was involved in a Wilson Center conference at George Washington University some years ago, and they brought these representatives from Hungary and Poland, all Romania, all these old allies, and all of them just dumped on the North Koreans, saying, those ingratiates, I mean, we did this and that, and I was a little bit shocked, you know, and so I think that is a reaction also to that kind of, I don't know, I don't really want to, I'd like to avoid a value characterization, I'd just like to say it as a fact of the world, that they do tend to start from themselves and interpret things around that. And I think that is really Chuche. And it does relate to Sadeju. So the other thing you could say is that they do take the bigger picture. The problem is they're taking a picture that goes back to Koguryo. So we don't really think of the big picture as contained. But if you go through the History Museum in Pyongyang, I mean, you say, this country has close relations with China, and they have all this stuff in this museum. I mean, it's like really anti-Chinese stuff. Now, albeit, it's about things that happened 2,000 years and more ago, but nonetheless, it's still there, right? And it's part of people's thinking. One last question, I guess, because we run over. Who? Close my eyes. Who? Mundako.
Thank you very much. My name is Moon from the Korean Consulate General. Thank you for your kind explanation and the result of your research on the DPRK China relations. But my question is very practical one. As of today, you know, North Korea, you know, tested its second nuclear test, and everybody is now increasing its WMD capabilities now. Everybody here is very worried about North Korea's future, you know, escalation. As for nuclear test, I think this is nobody in the world can accept nuclear test by North Korea, you know. So that's why we are now expecting China's proactive role in not to, you know, furthering this nuclear test. And also that's why we are asking China to exercise their leverage against North Korea, just asking North Korea to come forward to dialogue. So everybody is now ready to have a dialogue with North Korea. But as you, maybe it's not, as for your opinion, what will be, you know, China's proactive role at this stage to ask North Korea to come to the negotiation table?
Good question. What could China do to bring North Korea? Quite honestly, I don't know that North Korea is going to, aside from bilateral relations or bilateral negotiations with the U.S., I don't know how this is going to be solved. I don't know that North Korea is going to, I don't know that North Korea is going to be willing to, I mean, this is, North Korea has been trying to have or maintain dialogue with the U.S. for, I mean, I think from 68, this is when they really realized that, nothing was going to happen. I mean, you know, that you need to have dialogue with the U.S. and that, you know, you can have others involved, but North Korea believes, I think, that nothing is really going to happen unless it's just through bilateral relations or bilateral negotiations, rather. And they've been trying to get just bilateral negotiations with the U.S. from 1974. I mean, I guess this is the real turning point. You know, they saw what they could get in 68, and then from 74, they've been really pushing for this. And anything else, I think they believe, you know, just involves what they would call peripheral players. So I don't know that anything's going to happen or anything, or China could really affect any change, or could really, get the North Koreans to come back to the table. I think now it's, I mean, right now the U.S. I think needs to respond. I think the ball right now is in North Korea's court. I'm sorry. I just don't think China can really do a whole lot to get North Korea back to the table.
Okay. Thank you very much, James. And, thank you all for coming.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.